These are the Target Files. Journey back with us between the 1970s and 1990s on a TARDIS nostalgia trip as we look back at the novelizations and audiobook releases of classic Doctor Who stories. Accessing Gallifreyan Archive. Subject, Time Lord known as the Doctor. Fourth incarnation. Subcategory, Target Novelization. Doctor Who and the Giant Robot. Author, Terence Dix. Look, Brigadier, it's growing, screamed Sarah. The Brigadier stared in amazement as the robot began to grow and grow, swelling to the size of a giant. Slowly, the metal colossus, casting its enormous shadow upon the surrounding trees and buildings, began to stride towards the Brigadier. A giant metal hand reached down to grasp him. Can Doctor Who defeat the evil forces controlling the robot before they execute their plans to blackmail or destroy the whole world? Hello, welcome to the Target Files. Myself, Michael, here in Swansea.
And Alex here in Exeter. Happy Christmas, everybody.
Yes, happy Christmas to you, and coming up to the New Year as well. This time we are reviewing the Fourth Doctor, Terence Dix written novelisation of Doctor Who and the Giant Robot. Your initial thoughts on this opening story for Tom Baker's Fourth Doctor in novel format, Al?
Well, it's a really good read. It flows very well. It has the sort of great bits of getting Tom Baker's Doctor up and running. It's all fantastic. The whole sort of regen scene is done really well, and it's funny. And it has great characters. I think it works so well because it has really strong female characters who seem to do a lot of the work because of, you know, the Doctor regenerating is not completely there yet.
I've just written a few words down saying I think it's a good old-fashioned rip-roaring adventure yarn.
Most definitely, from start to finish. We actually start the villain sort of character, you know, doing something. We don't start with the Doctor, and I think it works really well. It's very pacing. It sort of doesn't stop right to the end.
Yeah, not a couple of writers we often compare with each other. It did put me in mind of a sort of a more faster-paced version of The Visitation that we reviewed earlier on in the year. That was Eric Saward, but the introduction of the bad guy at the beginning, in that case, it was a lot more measured.
It does feel more pacey than normal Terence Dix. It doesn't have that sort of, oh, we've got to set up a monster, what the Doctor sets up. It was like there from the start onwards.
Yes, I think we do see in the TV version, don't we? We do see the eye point of view of the giant robot, don't we? And he conveys that really well in the opening scenes.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. You feel and you understand the robot from the beginning, and he's sort of a really strong villain, I think, the robot. But I think it's not led by robots and monsters in this book. I think it's led by villainous humans.
Moving swiftly, nicely there, Al, onto the characters. As you mentioned, in your novel. You feel the female characters are strongly written in this book? I would certainly agree with you on that. What were their strengths?
Most definitely they are. I think you've got, you know, the scientist, I can't remember her name, you've got Sarah Jane.
So you did mention her, Al. Miss Winters and Sarah Jane, the main two female characters in this book.
I was just saying that Miss Winters and Sarah Jane are essential trick, major plot things. And Sarah Jane basically has nearly 3/4 of the book doing stuff, I would say.
Yes, I'm sort of really enthused by the fact she's obviously a well-established companion, having travelled with the Third Doctor at this point. But she really sets in motion the investigation herself, you know, being a journalist. You know, she's not afraid to wait for the Doctor to come round, is she, really, from his regeneration? She's straight in there investigating what's going on with a think tank.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. From start to finish, she leaves everything, and there's conflicts with the Brigadier, and she doesn't really need the Doctor. She doesn't rely on him completely.
No, and interestingly enough, the Doctor himself, as a difference to the TV version, it's actually told in flashback, his regeneration scene.
Oh yeah, do you think that works better? I actually think it works better in the book.
I think it does. It's an interesting narrative structure to use, really, isn't it? You know, it allows them more or less to dip in and out of the regeneration instead of focusing on it in one large chunk, which it would be in the text, I imagine, in the other regeneration stories.
Yeah, I think it works better in the book, as we said, because instead of going backwards and forth, you have it all. And I think, you know, the whole bits of the regen are so well done by Tom in this book, you know, the whole working out his costume and that.
Yeah, it's also one of the differences in the book, Al, is the Third Doctor regenerating is described quite horrifically, dramatically, isn't it? As he's actually writhing around in agony and twisting, whereas in the TV show, you know, it's very gentle, where you have the emergence of the Buddha character, the Choje character. It's a little bit more sort of horrific in this.
Yeah, it's more like, you know, sort of agony in what we've seen sort of in recent regenerations with Doctors this period. It feels more like the whole body's going, and it's really blissful, and I love the language of it in the book.
A lot of people have called it the gurning between Sylvester McCoy and Paul McGann in the TV movie. There's obviously a bit of pain you can see on screen there. You know, whether they didn't allow this in the 70s, really. Whether Terrence had plans in the TV version to make it seem a bit more of a horrific change from one incarnation to the other.
Yeah, I think the, as you said, the McGann's Sylvester McCoy one is really visceral. I just think it was probably the whole Mary Whitehouse era in the 70s where you couldn't show that sort of pain.
Yeah, I know, at the end of Planet of the Spiders, the last Third Doctor story, Pertwee looks very close to death, doesn't he? He looks very pale, the incarnation.
I think there's bits in that one, and the bits that when, you know, Tom goes into Peter, he looks very pale. I think that has definitely sort of changed, and they sort of went a bit lightweight with the way Tom comes about in the TV episode. In the book, it's really good.
Yes, and in the new series, you get the, we had Eccleston smiling, didn't we? And then we had David Tennant screaming into life as Matt Smith. And then just the quick cutaway, the old-fashioned cutaway, really, from Matt Smith to Capaldi.
Yeah, but do you think the gold light thing they did, they've all done with the most recent ones, improves it or not?
I'm not entirely sure. I think I'd kind of got used to the gold light one now, but then they used a totally minimalist approach, as I just said, with Capaldi, didn't they? It was more or less just a quick cutaway.
Oh, so yeah, they were with that, but I think they had to, because I was getting bored with the gold thing.
Yes, I mean, I suppose Moffat was really planning on a dramatic speech from Matt, wasn't he?
Yeah. Back to this with the characters, I do like how the female characters are more intelligent than the male science sort of characters.
Always the case in life as well, I think, Al, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely, most definitely.
They know how to put us gents in our place.
Definitely. I do like, I'm not going to say it's a great sport, but I thought that twist with one of the main characters was very good.
Oh, yes, I see what you mean there, Al. And as you said, Mrs. Winters, does she mind you of any sort of other fictional characters? She's very authoritarian, isn't she, in personality? Very sort of ice-cold. It's almost like two sides of a similar strong personality, isn't it, her and Sarah Jane? You know, Sarah Jane has the caring nature to her, but a very, very tough exterior. And Mrs. Winters just has the total hard-nosed need to be powerful, you know, and successful in her own despicable way.
Yeah, she reminds me of many people from sort of film, like, you know, sort of miswrapped it from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and it's sort of that whole sort of dominatrix sort of 70s power thing that was coming, really, I suppose, is in Miss Winter. Well, I like the fact with Sarah Jane, you don't need to have that sort of harshness. You can have the power and the feminism without the sort of militaristic hardness to it.
Yes, Al, I was actually trying to avoid saying the word dominatrix because of its modern
oh, yeah.
modern meanings on this this podcast of Target novelizations, but no. That's why I said authoritarian instead, but no, that's fine. I know what you meant, that sort of dominant really personality, isn't it? And there's some great...
the sort of thing they tried to do with Servalan in Break 7.
Absolutely, and they're probably at the very heart of this book, aren't they? The standoffs between her and Sarah Jane Smith.
Well, they are fantastic, because you can just see that Sarah didn't have like the heart and the doctor, she probably would be have the same sort of personality.
Yes, I think you have to give Terence his due. I think he does write female characters very strongly, you know, whether it's the ones who are stronger and have the intelligence to go with it on the TV version, such as Sarah Jane.
Oh, most definitely. He's very good at writing female strong characters. And I think we sort of saw that semi through the whole of the Pertwee era with, you know, with Joe and now her.
Yes, you know, you had Caroline John, first of all, Liz Shaw, very, very intelligent character. We had Joe Grant, seen as a bit more of the old-fashioned damsel in distress, wasn't she? But she also had a fierce intelligence that certainly developed in her character. And how do you... Is it a certain sort of snobbery you feel about someone like Leela, who's portrayed as a savage, but does have a great emotional intelligence in books such as Talons of Wang Chiang?
I think that, yeah, that throughout the Companions of Doctor Who females, it is snobbery with things like Leela, when they all think he's stupid, once he's seriously intelligent and can do things what other people can't do. And I think we've had that, you know, all for years, you know, with people like Sylvester McCoy with Mel, and, you know, with what we might be getting now, because people are feeling a bit, is Pearl McAleer's character going to be back to being stupid, but we all hope it's going to be intelligent, hopefully.
Yeah, you know, it's very strange, isn't it? Is it a case of us being snobbish? Do we go in with those preconceived ideas, or do the authors themselves play on those preconceived ideas and then develop the empowerment of these characters?
I think it's the problem with the general public that they see something and then they instantly surmise it into a category, I think.
Absolutely, Al, yeah, and we keep repeating sort of those mistakes, don't we, a lot, in terms of our judgment?
Oh, totally. These days it's just ridiculous, and it all, unfortunately, bleed more into politics next year. We won't go into that, will we?
Yes, we got, well, you know, that's what literature can do for you, though, isn't it, Al? It can educate wonderfully about the world, really.
Oh, most totally. You know, you can pick up a book and learn a complete another world, from Dickens to anything modern, you know, from Joseph Conrad to anything.
Absolutely, Al. And back onto the characters. What did you make of the stereotypically eccentric professor, really, Professor Kettlewell?
Well, he's a bit of an interesting one, because he sort of starts off as a stereotype of the idiot professor, it's all my fault, I invented these sort of things, and then sort of becomes something else, I don't give it away, and then becomes something else. So I think he works quite well.
Does. I think he starts off being sort of utterly bemused by the situation at the start, doesn't he?
Particularly, yeah, when totally. He's like, you know, why is this happening? And then slowly gets involved with UNIT, and then something else happens, and then by the end sort of works out he shouldn't have done this, really.
Oh, sorry, is the eccentricity stripped back to more bemusement at first, just so we can allow Tom's Doctor to be the main centre of eccentricity, really, because we know what a bonkers off-the-wall incarnation he was in the most wonderful way?
Yeah, I think so, because I think if you put two sort of eccentric people together at once, it might not have sort of brought out that sort of madness or brilliance of Tom. He got calmed down eventually, but it was still sort of pretty mad the whole Tom period.
Yes, wonderful. And on to the main man himself, Tom.
I
did love the use of the structure of the flashbacks, Al, because it allowed you to show up those various scenes we have of Tom saying things like, you know, the square of the hypotenuse, why is a mouse when it spins? He does the skipping and jumping with Harry Sullivan to trick him, doesn't he? And there's so much great eccentricity and humour within Tom straight from the word go in this.
It's just on the page, it's brilliant. I've watched it as well recently again. Just those first regen scenes are just so brilliantly shot. They're magnificent with him. He's just manic, and he's totally manic. And there's that one shot when he comes out of the TARDIS, astounded. It's just brilliant.
Yes, you know, on the brig, I love that turning of the humour when he comes out in his new outfit, and the Brigadier says, "Doctor, you've changed." And he runs to a mirror straight away and says, "What? Again? Again?" He thinks he's regenerated again, but literally he's just changed.
It's just brilliant.
He's just changed his clothing. Spoilers, folks. Sorry.
No, sorry. Do you think that Tom just had an idea, or did Tom just do what he always did, this works, and went for it?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen a lot of him pre-Doctor Who. I know he did the film Nicholas and Alexander, famously with Michael Jaston, who later appeared as the Valiard, and he did a few horror movies, perhaps a few TV shows. So I think eccentricity was always within Tom, you can tell now. He was just made for the role,
really,
wasn't he?
Nothing's really changed in the last 81 years. He's still as fantastic and bonkers as ever in whatever thing he does.
Yes, you know, I think the time was right for Doctor Who, wasn't it? You know, that you could say certainly Pertwee and Hartnell were a little more staid. We had Troughton, who was a bit more of a jester-type character, wasn't he? A cosmic hobo, as he's been described as. But we were ready for the full off-the-wall eccentricity of Tom. Absolutely, that point in the mid-70s, I think they were.
I think it works brilliantly, but does it get... Over the 8 years, do you think it slowly gets calmer and calmer, I think? Because I think he ran out of things by the end of his time. But in Robot, it is just fantastic from start to finish.
Well, he's just really sort of peed off, isn't he? And becoming he's admitted himself, a bit of a control freak by the last few years. You know, you see how tired he looks in that final season, how he looks quite gaunt as well in his personality. You know, he's had all the off-screen issues with being married to Lala and quickly divorced again. And Tom's life, isn't it, really? And it was probably right for a change. You know, Davison was my first Doctor, and yes, I think it was right for a change then, but the show always evolves, Al.
Oh, totally, totally. That's why it keeps going. It's because every time it'll be something different. I seriously expect when we get Chris Chibnall, it'll be something different again, and that's what's great about it.
Indeed, Al. Written well for Doctor Who before Chibnall and for Torchwood.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is Alex, this is Who's News. It's the 28th of December. Right, first thing we need to mention is the viewing figures for Doctor Who, Christmas Day episode, Doctor Who, Doctor Mysterio, did averagely well for Doctor Who. It came 7th in the ratings over Christmas, and got a viewing figure of 5.68 million, which for Doctor Who is extremely good, considering it hasn't been on air for a year, I personally think, and was up against Sky One's major film, The Last Dragon Slayer.
Okay.
It had a 27.1% share of the Christmas Day viewing, which for Doctor Who is extremely good. BigFinish.com have several new things coming out in January. First thing to discuss is The Diaries of Riversong Season 2. It's out, I presume, in the first week of January. It has Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy in, so Riversong will be meeting other versions of The Doctor. Also coming out in February is something new from Big Finish, a new experience. It's called Cicero, set in Roman times, dealing with politics and fun of the Roman society. It stars Samuel Barnett, who's been in such things as the BBC American version of Dirk Gently, Class, the spin-off to Doctor Who. BBC have finally decided to put it into its own BBC One schedule. Not in a primetime spot, which was apparently the idea, but now on at 10:40 on the 9th of January. Hopefully it will have audio description, and hopefully the ratings will pick up and get into about 2 million viewers, which is what that spot normally gets.
Shall we have a little chat about the covers, Al?
Indeedy. What's the covers?
It was Doctor Who and the Giant Robot novelisation. The initial cover. Oh, Peter Brooks. Okay, we've got the initial cover, 1970s, Peter Brooks. Doctor Who, red sort of Pertwee-esque logo. Within the O itself is a picture of Tom's head, but it looks to me like he's wearing a Stetson hat rather than anything else, because it's a little bit too wide on his head. Yeah, grey sort of background, more in line with the British weather.
Oh, yeah.
Quite a lot going on, more like a comic book cover. Planes in the air, a green and yellowish Who to the robot itself. The main focus is on the robot. Sarah Jane standing within a group of pillars, by the looks of it, within a circular motif. Agony and trepidation. Targets in the corner. There's just a lot going on that cover, I think, Al. Well, I suppose it is instantly recognisable as Tom.
Yeah, not one of a lot going on to me.
Yeah, there's a lot for a cover there, really. If I look at a few more.
But there are quite a few.
Quite a few. Well, yeah. There's another one, and the giant robot, printed a few years later. This just has a robot on the cover. Space, what? Nighttime in the background, the star behind the robot's head. You more or less just see the robot's head and top of his shoulders, really.
Well, that's a bit better, because it doesn't really say anything. What's a bit better than the first one?
Our good friend Alistair Pearson did one on a 1990s reissue. It has a Sylvester McCoy logo in that funny sort of banner effect, like a ribbon on top. We have Tom, definitely recognisably Tom, the right-hand side of his face slightly obscured by the robots within its mid-transformation, as we see on the screen, as it's getting bigger.
Oh, that's all good, then.
That's quite a decent one. I do like Alistair's one. And, of course, we did have a junior edition of this book, folks.
Oh, yeah?
Called Junior Doctor Who and the Giant Robot. We have Tom's face looking a little bit, to me, more like Gene Wilder in Willy Wonka, with a UNIT Land Rover in front of him. The robot to one side, not showing a great deal of menace, but I think that one would do for the kids, to be honest with you. So, yeah, a bit mix and match. I'm not really sure which is the most favourite one. I'll probably be biased and say Alistair Pearson, I think.
So it could do with more than just a robot, but I think it's better than too much stuff, or, you know, the logos don't represent. I'd probably go with the middle one as well.
Yes, we had the two, actually. The 1979 edition by Jeff Cummins, that was the one I just described with the stars in the background. And a bit of a darkened one by Jeff Cummins again in a 1980s reprint. So
I think it's still the one with just the robot on for me, because though it's a bit simple, it looks better, I think.
So you go for the Jeff Cummins.
Is that Jeff Cummins, or was it Andrew Pearson?
No, Alistair Pearson, whose heart is kind of half of Tom's face. And
No, I think I would still go with the one with just the robot on, I think.
Yeah, I think I won't be in total agreement. I think I'll just about go for the Alistair one. But, you know, I realise this is, to a lot of target readers, this is a very nostalgic and fond book. I imagine a lot of them. Let us know, folks, at DW Target Files. At DW Target Files. Let us know which of those covers is the favourite. And they did go for the one you used on the audiobook cover, Al.
They did, because I just think it looks good, but it's not brilliant.
Should we go on to the audiobook, Al? Released by BBC Audiobooks and read by John Baker himself, of course. What did you make of Tom's reading, the sound effects, the use of music?
Well, I think Tom reads anything brilliantly, because his voice is just brilliant. Sound effects very good, and the way they have the sort of robot having more depth and voice. Only niggle is Tom, unfortunately, can't do female voices. So his Sarah sounds like his male voices.
Yes, you get the essence of this being very much a military story, don't you? Because you have that sort of military motif used without, whenever there's a gap between chapters, whenever there's gaps within the chapters. And to be honest, it got a little bit annoying by the end. Did you find that at all?
A little bit. Well, I think I noticed in the late... I think they did that a lot with the later Tom Baker audiobooks, because books one's got... Brain of Morbius has got the same music between the chapters.
Yes, indeed, you know, and I agree what you said, really, about Tom does struggle a little with the female voices. Perhaps not at times, you know. I think we listened elsewhere to the Pyramids of Mars in the last couple of years, and there seemed to be a great deal more enthusiasm from Tom in that performance. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely, and I think I've listened to other things where he's read, you know, like Brent Morbius, and I think this one he's not that fond of, I don't think.
Well, what do you think his strengths are in this reading of the book? I think he does the male voices very well, the sort of military-esque versions, and he does convey that authoritarian nature of Miss Winters.
I would agree. He gets all the Brigadier, and he gets Benton's voice, and he gets sort of Harry's sort of sailor voice very well. I think it's a good reading. Well, Tom's very good at whatever he reads, because he's got a brilliant audiobook version voice. So it's just a shame he doesn't get women that great, but otherwise it's fantastic, I think. It's got a good soundscape as well when they do the robot and add more echo and volume to that.
Yeah, I know we know that Tom has sort of apparently mellowed from possible, we did mention, control freakery nature towards the end of his time as the Doctor. Do you get the impression he's possibly still a bit of a... can still be a bit troublesome to direct in these audio plays, do you think? Do you think he possibly takes over a little bit?
Well, when was this... Well, I think what I've heard, and more recent stuff he's been doing, the answer is no. But I think in this one, yes.
Yes, there's a famous clip, if you find it on YouTube, folks, of Tom Tom doing some outtakes from a commercially recorded back in the 1990s. It's well worth tracking down. He goes in a little bit of a rant about the narrative he's having to read out. It's quite amusing, folks. But
I know it's what you're on about. It's very amusing. But I think, because joining Big Finish and that, I think he has mellowed a bit.
Yes, indeed. I'm not going to say he was sort of phoning this one in, but I don't think it was as impressive as his performance as perhaps we'll say the Pyramids of Mars, as we mentioned before. We'll be doing that one again soon, I hope, Al.
Oh, most definitely. It's a really good book. And I think his performance has sort of got better over years when it comes to audio, because I think, you know, he's had producers like Nick Briggs and your Big Finish, you know, and now he's got this other thing, which is pretty, you know, the King of Cats, which is fantastic. And yes. I think he has got better. I agree. This one was sort of, I'm doing it for the money.
Is it Babblegaff?
Yeah, Babblegaff.
Babblegaff Productions have brought out Baker's End, haven't they, folks?
And it is fantastic. I got it about a week ago, the first one, and it is hysterical. It's like Tom Baker doing a parody of himself, and it is hilarious.
Brilliant. He can still do it at this age. It's great.
He can indeed. He's still got it at 81. He is fantastic.
In this year of all years, folks, we know about celebrities. And
I'm going to tap the wood next week. God, it's been terrible, hasn't it?
Indeed. So a pretty decent stab at the audiobook, Al.
Yeah, I would agree. It's enjoyable. It's a very good listen. But I know I have a few niggles, but otherwise it's Tom, so I just all let them go by.
Yes, back onto the book, Al. What did you make of the sort of resolution, the ending? We struggled with a few rushed endings in the past, but I thought this all came together nicely tied up by Terence.
Yeah, I think it works really nicely because you have the everything gets tied up pretty nicely, and you know, that sort of having Sarah completely down, and the Doctor's managed to make her happy, getting a third companion by windling Harry into things. I thought it worked out really well, really.
Yes, the only abrupt thing really is we kind of see the end of the UNIT era. They turn up in android form, don't they, in the android invasion, but it's sort of the left of the Brigadier typically to clear everything up bureaucratically, isn't it, as Dex jokes about in the text.
Most definitely. I knew what I was going to ask you. Do you think there's a bit of a weird connection between this and the Saigon, Tower of the Saigons?
The Tom Baker Saigon story or the Capaldi?
Yeah, the Tom Baker Saigon one.
Oh, yes, indeed. They did turn up in that again, didn't they, a few seasons later?
Yeah, they're in that. And I just want to know, there's no way of connecting. When I was looking at it, there's no way this gets connected to that, because there's no way the Doctor, has that homing device, doesn't he, from UNIT. I can't see how that came into it. Well, that's a sideline.
No, but let us know your theories on that, folks. Yeah, we'll have to get underway with the Saigon Terror again soon, Al, won't we?
Definitely, it is another good one.
I think we may look at a Tom Baker again next, folks, because there's so many of his stories to do, isn't there? So.
Oh, there's loads and loads. I don't know, it's very difficult to pick a one you feel bad about with Tom's stories. Yeah, I think some of the later parts of the Key's time were not that great.
Excellent, Al. So shall we round up and give our overall thoughts and scores on the novelisation
and audiobook?
Yes, Al, your overall thoughts on the novelisation and audiobook of Doctor Who and the Giant Robot.
I think it's a very good book. It's not one of Terence's books where he's painting by numbers, so it must be one of his first ones. It has a good plot, it has a convincing sort of villain, and for other people who make the villain even better because they're controlling it. It has good characterization. It has very strong females with Sarah Jane, who is one of those sort of companions you just love because he's brilliant. The audiobook is great because it's read by Tom. Whatever Tom reads is fantastic. Slight niggles about his female characters, but I can get over that. So I'd probably give the book a 8, and I'd probably give the audiobook a 7.5.
Very good, mate. Yes, I'd agree with you. Certainly, female characters so strongly written, very endearing in different ways, both of them. Sorry, I love the idea of Professor Kettlewell being so bemused at first by this strange bohemian character of Tom's Doctor coming in and meeting him and, suggesting to him his inventions have been used in such a horrific manner. Brigadier and Benton, bit of a sad goodbye to them in the series, really. Perhaps a little bit rushed. But, Terence manages the balance between humour, between keeping the narrative going, between the action scenes very well. As I mentioned at the beginning, a very great old-fashioned rip-roaring yarn. I'll give a 9 for the book itself, and a little bit disappointed with Tom. Tom's performance feeling a little bit phoned in compared to some of his other audio work, so I'll give the audiobook a 7.5.
Well, that is very good, that's very good.
Just an extra bonus for us this week, folks. Our thoughts, myself and Alex, on the 2016 Doctor Who Christmas special, The Return of Doctor Mysterio. What did you make of Doctor Who's return to this screen after a year's absence?
Well, I thought it was actually very good. I'm not saying it was perfect, because there were slight issues with character development, and the alien was interesting, but not that scary. Well, probably scary if you're a child. I thought that Capaldi's Doctor was very good. He had great sort of conflict and nice scenes with the child actor at the beginning of it. I actually warmed to Matt Lucas's character, Nardel, more. I think there is good chance of that being a good companion. But is it going to be... The only thing I worry about, is it going to be a bit crowded in the TARDIS with him and also Bill? But overall, I thought it was very good. I can see that there was a few problems, like, you know, some of the characters got overwhelmed by the Doctor's performance with them. But I think it needs a second watch. I've only watched it once on Christmas Day, where I wasn't completely compos mentis, because it was Christmas Day. But I think with a second watch, it will go up, in my opinion. How about you, Mike?
To be honest, Al, pretty average. I'm not a huge fan of the Christmas specials anyway. There's a handful I like to rewatch. It's just generally that I prefer a good story arc within a consistent series itself. I always feel these are a bit of fluff. I suppose they are wearing a bit thin after, I think, 11 or 12 specials now, you know. Not a lot of other TV shows outside soaps have that level of Christmas Day episodes, do they? You know, there have been some great ones. To me, it started off a little lamely. I was looking forward to it again, nicely built up by the reviewers, again saying it was one of the most wonderful Christmas specials ever. It was going to evoke Christopher Reeve's Superman films, which I absolutely adore and love. A lot of it just fell a little bit flat for me. I didn't think there was a great deal of charisma between the guest actors playing the Superman-esque Grant character and his Lois Lane-esque woman of his affections. To me, Capaldi and Lucas really managed to elevate it, lift up the screen. Peter is just getting totally into his character as the Doctor. I really hope he stays on under another showrunner. I do feel all credit due to Stephen Moffat that his scripts have become a little bit laboured, and perhaps Peter's a little bit wasted in his role as the Doctor under them. Not hugely impressed. A decent bit of fluff for Christmas Day, I'd call it. I'd probably give it only a 6 out of 10, I think, Al.
Well, I'm sort of with you semi on that. At the moment, I've given it a 6, because I agree with you on bits of it weren't that great. Like, you know, what was the point? This whole build up, you said it was like, you know, Superman. It wasn't. You know, you had a slight character who was sort of explaining why he had superpowers. But I think that the script could have been done better. I think you need, if you're going to have Doctor Who, you need it to have it's meant to be like a Christmas episode. And it was like 2 minutes to do a Christmas at the beginning, and it's like nothing more. Like, you need that sort of feel of Christmas nicety and snow. Like, I think also, like you, it has got a bit stressed, you know, every year expecting a Doctor Who Christmas episode, and it's like, what do you do next? Considering it's probably May or June when these are filmed, so it's like having to get into the Christmas spirit in June is always a difficulty. But I think overall it will get better. I think it's one of those ones that might get better after a couple of watches. But it was sort of not a good idea. What, the day before, I watched Voyage of the Damned on W, so I had that slightly in my head when watching it.
That is one of my favourites, Voyage of the Damned. I think a lot of those earlier RTD ones do get better. You make a good point, they do get better with repeated viewings. Perhaps this one will, Mysterio will. Gotta say, I love Peter as the Doctor. He commands the performance, as he did in that opening episode of Class, which I wasn't overly impressed with in terms of spin-offs, but he captured that episode brilliantly when he turned up in it. Disappointed overall. After a year's absence, I'd expected to be a little bit more entertained than I was on the day. I think, you know, perhaps that's to do with my mood at the time, this horrendous whole year of things happening, folks. But You know, I wasn't overly impressed with it this year, but it possibly has dampened my expectations for the new series. Wasn't overly impressed with the trailer, the coming soon trailer either, but I'll try and get my mojo back for Doctor Who by spring, hopefully April, Easter time it'll start.
I personally think that you will find episodes in season 10 you're going to like, because they've just got some good writers this year. But I, like you, have that whole concern of, is it a bit late, with it being Stephen Moffat's last year, to break a new companion in?
Yeah, if I'm honest, Al, I think his priority is Sherlock now. And I think, I'm not saying he's going to phone in these scripts for the new series. You know, Sherlock is such a massive brand. There's so much work involved getting those two main stars who both have Hollywood careers now all set up. I'm really looking forward to the new Sherlock. I just hope Chibnall, I honestly do hope Chibnall concentrates fully on Doctor Who, because I think to an extent Stephen and Russell before him have had to deal with other shows and spin-offs at the time, and they haven't given their full attention to Doctor Who. Would you agree with that at all?
I would, maybe not with Russell, but definitely with Stephen Moffat. He is so squashed. I don't know if him or the BBC wanting more to make more money out of Sherlock, but in the last two seasons he has sort of been so sort of torn between, do I do this, do I do that, what am I going to do, there's so much time, I've got to do this, because Benedict and Martin Freeman are mammoth super American stars these days, so it's getting them. I think it has affected how Doctor Who has gone, unfortunately. So I think with Chris Chibnall, who's sort of dedicating everything to the series, will make it better, I think.
Years hoping, Al, very hopeful for 2017. At least we're getting this series, that's the main thing, isn't it? We've gone a long year, without one.
I'm hopeful, but I also have really bad niggles. So I'm hoping that what everybody's been saying about Pearl McAtee is right, and that she is fantastic, and not what we've seen so far of her.
Bit harsh, isn't it, with just the one scene when she was more or less cast and harsh, the trailer. Yeah,
but it worries me, even with that trailer, it was beginning to annoy me.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, we know when Doctor Who came back nearly 12 years ago now. It was such a cool brand then, wasn't it? You know, have we possibly lost that? You know, possibly with the casting of an older Doctor, much as I love Peter, and it needs to stay in the public consciousness, and it needs more than ever to be a really strong dramatic series, doesn't it?
I think this is the whole problem. Though I love Peter Capaldi to bits, and I think his Doctor is fantastic, I think what with Chris Chibnall, you're also going to get brand new everything, and that will give the series a complete oomph again, I reckon.
So you do see there being a change of lead actor, do you?
Totally. I've seen it being from Chris Chibnall's in. I don't want Peter to go, because I think Peter's fantastic as a Doctor, but I think that the BBC will want Chris Chibnall to have a completely new thing they can merchandise and make into a new concept to get younger, because of course apparently younger people haven't been watching it as much since Peter Capaldi's been there.
Yeah, it's quite possibly. It's us old fanboys keeping it going, guys.
I've got definitely at the moment, because unfortunately, you know, they're used to people like the age of Matt and David Tennant, and they're like, now got Peter, who's, you know, twice their age as those actors, and it's like, we don't really get it.
Very true, very true. But as long as the story is good, it doesn't matter who's the Doctor, really, does it? You know, it's.
Do you think that Matt Lucas is going to work as a continuous companion?
I think he'll honestly dip in and out. Possibly, he was in quite small doses, wasn't he? I preferred him in this year's Christmas special to the Husbands of River Song last year. So,
but you do know you need to watch River Song again, because apparently there's a mammoth link to the villain in this year's.
Ah, I did hear about that. Oh, that was.
I wonder if you saw that. Did you see that? Well, there is a mammoth connection between last year and this year's, apparently.
Ah, so speculate and let us know, folks, at DW Target Files. But
Definitely. Because obviously, Stephen Moffat plans ahead.
As I said, though, about 6 out of 10 for me. Not the greatest, but, you know.
I think at the moment it's scoring, because I wasn't completely concentrating, and I think it was about a 6. When I watched it, I thought, well, this is good, but it needed a bit more. So I think at the moment it's getting a 6 on a first watch. Next time on the Target Files, we will be discussing Legopolis, written by Christopher Bigmead, and the audiobook read by Christopher Bigmead.
Doctor Who and the Giant Robot Review featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. I am the Doctor,
originally composed by Murray Gold. Version for this podcast by Grueling Terror 42. Newsround opening and closing themes by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Robot incidental music composed by Debbie Simpson. No copyright infringement intended on any of the music used in this podcast. Doctor Who and the Giant Robot Review was recorded in Swansea, South Wales and Exeter, Devon, England during December 2016.